works much better. Can you hear me now? Okay. It's a little technology goes a long way sometimes. As I was saying, tonight is the second of these talks on the Four Noble Truths. And so tonight I'm going to talk about the second noble truth. And first I want to remind you about something. And that's last week when we talked about the first noble truth, we decided that the best translation of the first noble truth is something along the lines of life is unsatisfactory. And I want to be very careful to say that I don't want you to construe that as negative, which is what I did when I first heard these teachings, you know, 45 years ago, and I first heard Buddhist teachings, said, oh, these Buddhists, what a bunch of downers, are always talking about suffering. Remember what the instruction said. It said to understand as it is what dukkha is. And so the first noble truth is encourages us to be realistic, to see things as they really are. And it's not saying in any sense that it's inevitable that you're going to be miserable. It's because that's certainly not true. In fact, the rest of the teachings are about how that isn't true. The first, we have to sort of take it in very deeply that, yeah, the way we live our lives in the world in a normal fashion is unsatisfactory in terms of bringing happiness to our lives. But it isn't necessarily always going to have to be that way. And the whole of the teachings are about how to change that, which is what I'm going to start talking about tonight. So in the Satipatthana Sutta, the instructions on meditation, what the Buddha says, he says, he knows as it really is, this is the arising of dukkha. Where does dukkha come from? Where does this unsatisfactoriness come from? Why is it that way? And then he goes on to say in the Second Noble Truth, basically, that dukkha is caused by what's called tanha, which roughly translates as grasping or craving. And once again, this is a word that has often been mistranslated. Often you see it translated as desire. But desire is actually a pretty neutral force. Sometimes it can be wholesome, sometimes it can be. I mean, you had a wholesome desire to come and sit with me here tonight. This is a wholesome thing, right? Hopefully it is. And so desire in and of itself isn't the problem. It's when desire turns into grasping or craving. And that's like, now it's not just, gee, that'd be nice. It's like, I got to do it. And I got to do it right now. It's like, I got to have this stuff right now. There's nothing. It's a thirst or an unsatisfied longing. That's tanha. It's much stronger than just plain old desire, which, as I said, can have be either wholesome or unwholesome. And why is this grasping, this craving, so much so problematic? In the teachings on the 12 steps of codependent arising, which is one of the original teachings of the Buddha, basically what happens is grasping or craving leads to what's called clinging. Special meaning to that word within the Buddhist teachings. But you grasp, you cling, and then you suffer. That's where it's because we're clinging that the unwholesomeness, the unpleasantness, the unsatisfactoriness arises. And so I want to just briefly look at this teaching on the 12 steps of codependent arising, because it's important that we understand this. And basically, I'm not going to go through all 12, but basically what happens is something arises at one of our sense doors. We see something, taste something, smell something, feel something, think something. Something arises in one of our sense doors. And immediately following that, this mental factor called Vedana arises. Vedana, one of those Pali words with no really good translation, roughly translates as feeling tone. It has the flavor of what just arose. And Vedana only has three forms. So it's kind of nice, it's simple. You can either be pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And this is a purely instantaneous mental factor that arises immediately after we have a sense impression. We have the sense impression, Vedana arises. And then based on the Vedana, we start to grasp. If it's pleasant, then we want more. I want it. I want more of it. I want to keep it. I want to make it permanent, which we know is a problem because we know from last week's talk that everything's impermanent. And in making it, we want to make it impermanent so we can have it forever. I want it always. I want more of it. I want to keep it. Or if the Vedana is unpleasant, we try and push it away. This is just wanting more in reverse. It's the opposite side of the same thing. You know, trying to push something away has exactly the same energy as trying to hold on to something in the mind. And in both cases, that pleasant or that unpleasant Vedana leads from either grasping or pushing away to clinging. Clinging is like, now I'm holding on really tight. I'm not ever going to let this go. This is it. I'm going to hold on to this forever. I want this. I'm going to keep this. That's where the suffering arises, because in our wanting to keep it, or in our wanting really, really strongly to push it away. And remember, to push something away, we first of all have to make very strong contact. So we cling both to things we want to keep and things we want to push away. We have to get this. If I want to push something away, I can't sort of put my little pinky on it and very gently touch it. I got to grab a hold of the darn thing and fling it mentally. So we cling in either extreme. And then if we're trying to push it away, well, sometimes it goes away, sometimes it doesn't. We suffer. We want to hold on to it, well, then it goes away. We suffer. So it's like it's inevitable that in acting in this way, we set ourselves up for trouble by just as things flow naturally, you know. And so what we need to do when the Buddha says, well, he knows as it really is, this is the arising of dukkha, what we need to do, what we need to understand is how this clinging arises. Why is it we are so strongly motivated, in a sense, to keep clinging over and over and over and over and over in this cycle? The teachings on codependent arising are like a ring. We just keep going around in a circle over and over again. Something arises, we go through these steps, we suffer, and then, oh, here we go again, and here we go again, and here we go again. Why do we keep getting caught in this vicious circle? And to do that, we have to take a very close look at the ways that we cling. What is it that we actually cling to? What is it that motivates us to cling? And there's actually four different things that we cling to, four different layers of this problem. And the first of these is sense pleasure through objects, the obvious one, you know, something. We have something good to eat and we want more of it. We cling to it just by simply, you know, thinking, oh, well, that was great. Now I want a second helping, but there's none left. Or I wanted to work in my garden today because it's so pleasant to be out in my garden working. Well, I didn't get to work in my garden today because guess what? There's a foot and a half of snow in my garden. You see what I mean? It's like we want something and we want it because it's pleasant. And then sometimes we get it and sometimes we don't. Sometimes it's there and then it's gone. And it's just, we somehow keep fooling ourselves into believing that if we just somehow or other figure out a way to get all the good stuff that we want at the same time, if I can just line everything up so that all the things that I think of as pleasant all are there, that somehow then I'll be happy. But no matter, and sometimes we get close to that maybe. You know, sometimes we have really good days or good weeks or good years maybe, who knows? And then something changes. Because it's inevitable that something's going to change. Inevitable because everything is impermanent. Everything is changing all the time. So no matter how much I want things to be permanent, I want things not to change, they're going to change. And that stuff that makes me happy goes away. So this is like an unsatisfactory method of finding happiness. And I don't want to in any sense suggest that those things aren't pleasant. I mean, I just had a piece of homemade gingerbread with coconut milk ice cream for dessert. And let me tell you, it was really pleasant. I mean, we can't deny that fact that those things are pleasant. But they're impermanent. They're gone. They're not, I can't, and if I kept eating homemade gingerbread with a coconut ice cream, after a while, it'd be very unpleasant. Same object, but now it would be like, oh, my fourth piece. Well, this is, it wouldn't be pleasant at all. Just so even the object, it isn't the object itself that has the pleasant unpleasantness to it. It's the mental space we have around it. And I want to actually want to read a little, this is a little story here. This is from Joseph Goldstein's book, The Experience of Insight, which is the first Buddhist Dharma book I ever read that made me take up this practice, say 18 years ago now. This was the book that did it for me. And I still keep going back to it, even though he's written other books. There's parts of this book that I love. Anyhow, so this is a story about Mulla Nasruddin, a famous Sumi teaching figure. One day he went to the marketplace and saw a big bushel of hot chili peppers on sale. He bought them, returned home, and began to eat. A little while later, his disciples came and saw the mullah with tears streaming down his face, his mouth and tongue burning. Mullah, why do you go on eating them? As he reached for another, Nasruddin replied, I keep waiting for a sweet one. This is what we do over and over and over and over. We keep waiting for the sweet one, even though we keep getting burnt. That's because we cling to these pleasant sensual experiences. It's okay to enjoy them. I'm not for one second saying we shouldn't enjoy things, but it's when we get attached to them, when we gotta have them, when I really can't live without homemade gingerbread with coconut milk ice cream. That's when it's a problem. That's when I'm clinging, and that's when I'm bound to have unpleasantness arise in my life. I'm bound to suffer. I'm bound to experience unsatisfactoriness because I can't always have that. It just doesn't work that way. So that's the first thing we cling to, sensual experiences in their vast and wonderful array. Now it starts to get more complicated because that one's pretty obvious. It's pretty obvious sensual pleasures are things we cling to. Now we go to some of the more subtle things. So the second thing the Buddha mentions is what he calls views and opinions. We cling to our views on how things should be, our opinions that they should be a certain way, that we know this is right, this is wrong, I'm right, you're wrong, we are right, they are wrong. Views and opinions. And these are partly intellectual. You know, we read something or we studied something or we had a long series of conversations with someone and came to believe that Democrats are right and Republicans are wrong. Or maybe only independents are the ones that are only ones that really understand what's going on in the world. And all those political parties are nonsense. Or. Pick your view. And so these are partly intellectual and partly they're cultural. Partly they're things like how we grew up, how we sort of literally from the cradle on are taught that certain things are the right way to do things and other things are wrong. And those are deeply held cultural views that are so deeply embedded that we don't even see how much they affect how we react in the world, how much we cling to those views, how much we think, I know I'm right. I know they are wrong. I know this is correct. I know this is incorrect. And so we don't even see these things operating in our lives, but they're there operating very strongly all the time. And we don't see them because they seem so natural. They seem like, well, of course. If you want to catch yourself in clinging to one of these views and opinions, watch for the following sort of thoughts in the mind. Thoughts like, well, of course it's that way. Or, that's just the way it is. It always has been that way. It's tradition. It's like what pick your spiritual teacher taught. So it must be right. These are just views and opinions. And as long as we cling to them, we're going to have rude awakenings because we discover that other people have other very different views and opinions about the same things. And you look at all the conflict in the world, political conflict, social conflict, how much of that arises simply because people have different views and opinions and then fight about it, go to war about it. The untold suffering arises from people clinging to their views and opinions of how things should be. That I'm right, they're wrong. We are right, they are wrong. It's where enormous trouble in the world arises from this clinging to these opinions. And it doesn't mean, once again, that you shouldn't have opinions. You should just, you know, because we have to function in the world and we need to have some sort of guidelines, guide rails, in a sense. But it doesn't. It means is that though we have those opinions, we have to be open to the fact that, gee, you know, maybe we start having a conversation and someone says something, and we go, maybe I should look at it that way. Maybe I should think about it this a different way and see if that makes sense. And we have to have that flexibility, not to cling to them, not to be so sure all the time that I know what's right. Because our mind is always going to be clouded. It's like the views and opinions are like filters over the brain, that we see everything through these filters. Someone called the third Zen patriarch. Famous Zen patriarchs are famous for sayings of various things. This is one of my favorites from the third Zen patriarch. It says, do not seek the truth. pretty sharp. Do not seek the truth. Only cease to cherish opinions. Do not seek the truth. Only cease to cherish opinions. That would be a pretty interesting life if you could, we could stick to that. How we stop cherishing these views and opinions that we believe. And we just take things in as they're arising and understand them from there and work with them from there. Excuse me for a second. Okay. So that's the second level of things we cling to, views and opinions. And then a third one, and this one is somewhat particular to the time of the Buddha, but it's very applicable today in a different sense than probably the Buddha originally meant it. And he said, we shouldn't cling to rites and rituals. And you have to remember that in the time of the Buddha, in the Hindu culture that he grew up in and was part of, the whole of the culture was totally based on rites and rituals. Anything you wanted to do, plant a crop, try and get pregnant, have a baby, have a marriage, have this, have that. No matter what it was, the Brahmins, the priestly caste, had a rite and a ritual to make it happen better, to make it official in some way. And everything, your whole life, was based on following these particular rites and rituals. And the Buddha said, nah, no way. He was he almost got murdered by Brahmins who objected to him saying this sort of thing a couple of times. And he just basically said, this is, in his culture at that time, this was a huge problem. For instance, the culture also said things like, well, you were born a woman. Too bad. Next lifetime, maybe you'll be lucky enough to be born a man, and then you can study. And then just go back to the kitchen and take care of the man. That was your job. That was just the way the culture was. Well, the Buddha said, the heck with that. And he took women into his sangha all the time. He was very open, which at that time, this is 2,500 years ago, in North India, was like this radical thing to do. He also took in untouchables. He took in anybody of any class to come and join the Sangha. And this was like, this totally broke all the rules. This was against all tradition, where only Brahmins could study. Only Brahmins could practice. Only Brahmins could teach. And he just turned that whole equation upside down. Well, what about our culture today? How does this apply to our culture? Well, if you live in Boulder or anywhere around Boulder, you know how much, quote, spiritual stuff goes on. All these different sort of forms of practice and teaching. And everyone, if they're not careful, gets into my form of practice. In fact, my form of Buddhist practice, with its own special rituals, like, you know, chanting the refuges at the beginning of a sit. That's the right way. And all these other people who do other things don't understand. They don't have it right. I know our way is the right way. Talk about a chance to lead into disaster and suffering. That's what goes on all the time. And then there's all this sort of new age beliefs that people cling to. I'm allowed to talk about new age things because I grew up in that period. I was a hippie, you know, long hair, didn't cut it for 3 years. I was one of those people. So I'm allowed to joke about it you know, the belief back in that day that the Beatles song "All You Need Is Love" was the perfect answer to everything. Well, yes, we need love, but it's a lot. We need a lot more than that. We also need discipline, and we need common sense, and several other things as well. And on and on. We all know what I'm talking about. Especially if you live anywhere around Boulder, you're exposed to this stuff every day. And I'm not saying that all of these different forms of practice and ideas about how to express spirituality are bad or incorrect. Oh, it's just that people cling to them. People think this is the right way. This is the only right way. All those other ways are wrong. You know, think about all the wars in the world going on based on religious belief, on people thinking that they've got it right, including Buddhists in Myanmar right now who treat Muslims horribly. I mean, horribly. Based strictly on their Buddhist religion. So no religion, no spiritual group is immune to this. In any sense of the word, immune to it. People cling to these things, and it causes their suffering and the suffering of others. Mm. So that's the first three: sense pleasures, views and opinions, rites and rituals. Now we come to the fourth thing we cling to, and this is the one that, to be honest, for me is the most difficult to grasp, but it is sort of central to the Buddhist teachings. And that's, we cling to this idea of a separate self, that somehow there's me, not me. I'm separate from all those people on my screen whose smiling faces I can see. They're them, I'm me, we're separate. The sense of separate self is the deepest and most difficult issue we have to struggle with in terms of clinging. I want to once again read a little bit from Joseph Goldstein, from this book and then from another book, actually. So we'll get a real taste of Joseph Goldstein here. The fourth of the bonds, and the most subtle, the most deeply conditioned, is our attachment to the belief in self, in I, in me, in mine. The belief that there is some permanent entity in the mind body which is experiencing all of this. Because of this belief, and to satisfy the I, the self, we get involved in all kinds of unwholesome actions, all kinds of greed and hatred, all kinds of delusion for the gratification of the self, which isn't even there. Our attachment to the concept itself is so great that everything we do revolves about it, tying the bonds even tighter to this mass of pain. Pretty strong words, but it's true. We are so sure that I'm separate, that somehow I'm different and separate from all of you. And it is to maintain that belief, I will do anything, almost anything at all, to maintain that belief. It's incredible what people do to maintain that belief. And it causes untold problems in our life and in the lives of everyone around us. One of the people I've spent some time studying with is a woman named Carol Wilson, who is quite blunt when she teaches sometimes, and somewhat colorful in her language, shall we say. So I hope no one is offended by this, but the thing I remember her saying more than anything else is the problem with the people is that we all believe the same thing. And what we believe is basically this: I'm a little piece of shit that the world revolves around. And doesn't it just capture how we act in the world often? It's so such a beautiful, blunt way of describing things. We just think the world, everything revolves around us. Because I'm separate and I'm the center of everything and everything else happens because I'm in the middle of it all. And this is sometimes if you're one of those people who studies the books and literature and teachings, you'll often come across the phrase, the craving for becoming. It's like, I want to keep existing. I want to keep coming, becoming. I want to keep going. I want this I not only to exist, but to be permanent. I want it to be there always. And this causes problems. This is another, this is from Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness, his most recent book, actually. This is somewhat longer reading, but please bear with me. It's called The Craving for Becoming, for Renewed Existence. This is the very basic urge or desire to be. It is desire for continuing existence, particularly in pleasant realms. We may or may not believe in rebirth and different planes of existence, although they are often mentioned in the Buddhist teachings. But we don't have to believe in them in order to experience this powerful craving for becoming. We can see it in the planning mind, in the act of imagining ourselves in some future situation. We might be planning for something at work or perhaps for our next vacation. It all starts with just a thought, and then weeks or months or even years later, a whole chain of thoughts and actions has materialized in our lives. Notice how often we get lost in the mind fantasies of a future self. I'll do this. I'll go there. It's pretty prevalent these days, huh? How many times have we thought, gee, after this is over, then I'll be able to X. Go for a hike with my friends in the mountains. Go to a nice restaurant and have a meal, whatever it is. How many times do our minds go there? I'm sure we all know exactly what I'm talking about, because we're all human beings and we're all caught in that space. But it's like, it's pretty, one thing about our current situation is it makes this very obvious, what he's saying, because it's something we're doing all the time. And we see it so clearly, because now, there's this craving for becoming, this craving for something to happen in the future that we can't make happen. And it's unpleasant. Losing ourselves in these projects is a manifestation of craving for becoming. In a sutta called One Fortunate Attachment, the Buddha gave clear advice for freeing ourselves from this craving. Let not a person revive the past or on the future build his hopes, for the past has been left behind and the future has not been reached. Instead, with insight, let him see each presently arisen state. Let him know that and be sure of it, invincibly, unshakably. So, there's that fourth layer of clinging, that clinging to this sense of self. This is also, by the way, the most difficult one to overcome. When the Buddha was talking about the night of his enlightenment, that moment when he finally was released from suffering, Remember afterwards, after his enlightenment, what the Buddha called himself often was the one who no longer suffers, the one who no longer lives in a world of unsatisfactoriness. But the last thing he had to let go of, he said, there he was, right on the edge of enlightenment, and the last thing he had to let go was a subtle sense of self. Even after all those lifetimes and years of deep practice, there he still had a subtle sense of self, and that was the last thing he had to release. And when he released that, then enlightenment arose. So this isn't something we're going to have to sort of like, oh, well, you know, I'll take care of that next week. This is something that all of the practice revolves around, getting to that point where we can do that. This is the practice leads in this direction. It's not easy. And to be honest with you, I don't completely even understand this. If I understood it, I'd be enlightened, and then you'd be getting into different Dharma talk. But I've had little glimpses of this. I've had little subtle bits of understanding about it from deep practice. And I realized how much I don't know, which is probably at least somewhat skillful. To know what you don't know is probably a good start at least. Because it isn't something that we just need to understand intellectually. We can sort of grasp this intellectually, perhaps. We can sort of take, yeah, I can see what he's saying there. It sort of makes sense. But this is like, we have to know as it really is. To know as it really is what it means to cling to this sense of self. So why is it that we cling? Why is it that we keep going back to this idea of clinging to things? There's a kind of a famous teaching story I really like. It's called the monkey trap story. And this is actually a way in Southeast Asia where people capture monkeys. And it's based on the fact that monkeys want things. It's like other human beings. They have the strong desires for certain things, and they act out of that desire. So what they do is they take a coconut, drain the milk out of the coconut, attach a wire to one end of the coconut, and they drill a hole in the coconut that's just big enough for a monkey's hand spread out to slide through, and then they put something that the monkey would really like, some sort of bait, inside the coconut. The monkey comes along. Ooh, there's something really great, something I really want. Now there's craving. Slides his hand, just barely fits through the hole, grabs a hold of it, and now he's made a fist. His hand isn't spread out. Now it's made into a fist because he's holding this thing in his hand, and he can't get his hand out of the coconut anymore. He's caught by his own craving. This is how what we do. We get caught by our own craving over and over. We fall into the monkey trap over and over and over again. And so where does this lead? This leads to the thought of what we need to do is let go. You know, all the monkey has to do when they're trapped with that coconut is open their hand and let go of that thing. That's all. Just let go. So we're saying that unsatisfactoriness is a choice. We choose, consciously and unconsciously, choose to live in a world that's unsatisfactory, in a mental world that's unsatisfactory. And I'm not saying that magically, if we just let go, everything's going to be perfect. Because we're still going to get old. We're still going to get sick. We're still going to die. We're still going to lose everything we ever have. That isn't going to change. What's going to change is how we react to those things. It's like the unsatisfactory arises because we cling to things. What the Buddha is saying is we just need to see that, to know as it really is, this is the arising of dukkha. It's the clinging to things that causes the pain and suffering, both for ourselves and for everyone around us. This isn't just for me. It's for all those other people who I interact with every day who suffer because I'm so busy trying to take care of, get my stuff that I cause troubles for other people. And so it's somehow that the rest of the teaching, the rest of this teaching has to do with how we can choose to react to what's arising at the sense doors so that we don't cling. That's what the rest of these talks are going to be about. We've got to the point where we've accepted that. We have understanding that things aren't satisfactory. Hopefully from this talk, you have a fairly clear idea of the how it, as it really is. This is how things arise, how that unsatisfactoriness arises in our lives. And so now we just have to skillfully do something about it, which was what the rest of this series of talks is going to be about. But I want to, those of you who know me know I can't do a Dharma talk without reading some poetry. So I want to just finish with, this is a book called Go In and In by Dana Faulds. And the poem is called Being Present. Being Present. Breathe, relax and feel. Take time to slow down the pace of life. Watch the rise and fall of moods, the birth and death of dreams. Feelings and sensations seem so real, yet they shift like changing clouds and flow with the high tide out to sea again. Allow it all to be, no need to grasp or push away. Present with each moment, the whole of you, body, mind, and soul, opens to receive.